Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do our politics change our language? And do the words we hear and use have the power to impact the way we think about the issues of the day? Consider this. Is there a difference in your mind between salvaging items you found in a flooded building and looting a building after a storm? What about the distinction between being affluent and being rich, or aid in dying as opposed to assisted suicide? Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist at UC Berkeley and chairman emeritus of the Usage Panel for the American Heritage Dictionary. He is also a frequent commentator for the New York Times and NPR's Fresh Air. He writes about 21st century language trends in a new book called The Years of Talking Dangerously. Jeff, welcome back to Think.
Oh, well, thanks very much for having me.
To the extent that the really significant new language of the 21st century is the language of politics, why now?
Well, it's been a very political time, even before 9/11, and then, of course, the opposition to the Bush administration and the ferocious support for its policies created a world in which it seemed as if everyone was using political language. It's funny because every age seems to have a characteristic language when you look back on it. If you think about the 60s, you think, what, rock, drugs, sex, rock, drugs, and disaffection. The 70s, what, disco, new age, the 80s. Management jargon, valley girl talk, and so forth. The 90s, you think of techno speak and fit speak, I suppose, buff and all that language. And in the first decade of the 21st century, it's been the language of politics more than any other, I think.
There are some highly skilled political professionals these days, people like Frank Luntz and George Lakoff, who earn their livings deliberately couching issues and creating new catchphrases. Is there any real precedent for this phenomenon in our political past?
Well, I don't think there have been anybody, language professionals, I don't know if Lakoff earns his living doing that, but Luntz certainly does. And language professionals have only recently gotten into this business. And in a funny way, it's an offshoot of the way in which these branding experts and naming experts have created a whole industry based on the proposition that assigning just the right name to your pharmaceutical or your cola drink or whatever it is will be sufficient to get you those extra 3 feet of shelf space in the supermarkets and put it over the top in a world in which competition is so great for public attention. So it's just, in a sense, an extension of marketing techniques that have really developed in the last 30 or 40 years.
So let's talk about some of the terms we are using or not using because of some of these efforts. The Bush administration, for example, worked very hard to avoid using the phrase civil war and the word torture to describe things that, by many definitions, would indeed have fit those descriptions. What effect would those words have had if we had used them as a culture?
Well, torture is an interesting word. After the Abu Ghraib photographs first came out, it was astonishing how reluctant the American media were to use what Rumsfeld described as the torture word. So it was abuse or whatever. And in the meantime, the European press, even Murdoch's European press, was using the torture. Was using torture all the time. So there was a reluctance to use the word, I think, because It came with a certain stereotype of abuse and evil, and torture is just something. It's an absolute evil, and so people had to dance around with it. This phrase, enhanced interrogation techniques, came in, and Bush gave a speech on this, and he used the word professionals about 15 times. Our professionals are doing, which suggested not only that they knew what they were doing, but they probably weren't getting any pleasure out of it because they're professionals. So there was this real effort to distance themselves from the word torture, to the point of writing, having these memos written, Bybee's memo in particular, which defined torture basically in terms that admitted only pain equivalent to destroying somebody's organs or breaking legs or pulling out fingernails and so forth. And using that definition, managed to deny that they were doing anything like torture, even though what was going on clearly was torture by international conventions, and I think by the ordinary understanding of the word.
Do you think maybe that was some of the reluctance on the part of Americans who might not have supported those efforts at all? But in saying torture, it does sort of admit a sort of societal culpability in the whole thing.
Well, there are two points. There are people out there, there is no small number of them, who say, I don't care if it's torture, if we need it to get valuable intel, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And there were a fair number of people particularly on the right, who were talking like that. There were other people who were a little squeamish about saying, I don't care if it's torture. So they said, well, you know, it's not really torture. I'm against the torture, mind you, and this, of course, with the administration's position. I'm against torture, mind you, but, you know, pushing somebody a little hard, shoving someone around, giving them a bad, and there were all these extraordinary ways of euphemizing and extenuating what was going on.
There's always a ticking time bomb in the situation, I guess.
I'm sorry?
There's always a ticking bomb.
Yeah, it was always the ticking time bomb. You know, what's interesting is nobody's ever argued that you should we should legalize these techniques people in the ordinary criminal. I mean, if you find somebody who may have kidnapped a person and so on, should we legalize torturing that person to find out where the kidnapped victim is? And nobody supports that. But in the context of terrorism, people have obviously argued in favor of it.
And what about, you know, we don't hear it much anymore at all, but there was a time when a lot of people were debating the question as to whether there was a civil war that had been spawned in Iraq.
Right. The administration was saying, no, this isn't a civil war. I think it's an exchange of views. I can't remember how. I have it in the book, but there was a euphemism. It's almost unmemorable, which is in a certain way what euphemisms are for. They're supposed to be forgettable, that the administration was using. And they also came up with a definition of civil war that meant, armed combatants had to take the field in uniform. There was a whole list of criteria. 2,000 people or more had to be killed and so on. Well, the requirement that people wear uniforms was sufficient by itself to ensure that not only was what was going on in Iraq not a civil war, it never would or could be. But again, in the common parlance, what was going on was a civil war, and perhaps has been resolved now, but there's no question that it was a civil war.
Does it matter that President Obama has renamed the War on Terror to the Overseas Contingency Operation?
Yeah, I think there's a case. Now, obviously, Overseas Contingency Operation has something of a bland, bureaucratic, euphemistic character itself, but this might be a case in which that's exactly what you want. The War on Terror was problematic for a lot of reasons. For one thing, terror is a technique, not an enemy, and what we were making war on was not terror in general, but a particular parties and particular groups. For another, to talk about a war on something is always to imply a kind of endless struggle, like the war on crime, the war on sin, the war on polio, and so on. That won't be resolved in our lifetimes. That will go on and on and on and on. And the very image of a war implies a military rather than a combination of military, diplomatic, and economic initiatives. So there was lots of reason for being uncomfortable about the war on terror. Of course, if you want to marshal support for a position, calling it a war is exactly what you want to do, whether it's terror or drugs or anything else.
I think it's fascinating, Jeff, that we see in the book that this debate over how we use certain political words and phrases is not limited to the public sphere. Dictionaries have had to get sort of political in handling things. Will you talk about the word marriage as we argue so passionately about whether that legal status should belong exclusively to couples of the opposite sex?
Right. It's remarkable about the debate over gay marriage is how often you see this cast as a semantic problem. People say, "Well, speaking of gay marriage is an oxymoron. That is, it's a contradiction in terms, or it's an offense against the English language." As if their opposition to the to gay marriage was basically out of the interest in preserving the sanctity of not of marriage, but of the English language. Nonetheless, dictionaries are caught in the middle of this. For one thing, dictionaries themselves are written by people who share the assumptions of their times. And if you look at definitions of very common words that involving relations between the sexes, but not necessarily marriage, you see that dictionaries have very often maintained attitudes that were common at the times the dictionaries are written, but that now strike us as bizarrely out of date. The Oxford English Dictionary just went back a few months ago and revised a bunch of definitions. They define girlfriend, for example, in the sweetheart meaning, as a man's favorite female companion, which meant that a woman, in effect, couldn't have a girlfriend as a sweetheart. Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas couldn't be girlfriends. They finally revised that. A couple was defined in a way that permitted only men and women to constitute a couple, but not two people of the same sex. And even love was defined as that feeling of attachment which is based upon difference of sex and which is the normal basis of marriage, which meant that, say, Shakespeare couldn't have had felt any love for his male friends. So, and they finally got around to revising that a couple of decades, or in some cases a couple hundred years too late. What it means is that when we talk about the traditional definition of a word, we're often talking about a definition that was shaped by a whole bunch of background assumptions and often background prejudices that may or may not be relevant today. And it's the same with marriage, although with marriage, dictionaries are a lot more reluctant to just change the definition. Some have. The Encarta Dictionary simply says a marriage is a legally recognized relationship between two people who intend to live together as sexual and domestic partners. No mention of sex or gender. Other dictionaries will give two definitions. They'll give one definition for same-sex marriage and another definition for opposite-sex marriage, as if these were two different meanings of the word. I think there's a kind of cop-out in that, because nobody really thinks that. If they were really two different meanings of a word, we wouldn't be having these arguments.
Well, and it leads to the question of how important it will be ultimately for proponents of same-sex marriage to get that qualifier removed so that it becomes as impolite to say same-sex marriage as it might be today to call someone a lady lawyer or a male nurse.
Absolutely. I think that's a very good point. And once the same-sex disappears and you simply talk about marriage, the opponents of it have lost. People can still have, of course, religious qualms about it, which is perfectly fine. Sorry, but they can't cast it as a semantic problem. They can't say the meaning of marriage doesn't allow this. The meaning of marriage already does. And whether you want to countenance it among members of your religious group or whatever is an entirely different question.
What factors tend to influence how open or how resistant Americans in particular are to accepting new terms or changing the definitions of terms that have already existed?
Well, Americans have traditionally been, on the one hand, very open to accepting new words. That's why one of the reasons the American English in general and American particularly is so rich, because of our ability to absorb words from many different languages and cultures. What we sometimes do, and what's very interesting, is that we'll change the meaning of a word, but pretend that we haven't. So it's sort of like what companies do when they have an old lustrous brand and they attach it to a low-end product, mm-hmm. in the hope that people will continue to buy the product. Because, you know, when I was growing up, Abercrombie, I couldn't afford to shop at Abercrombie & Fitch. Now I can, and that isn't because I'm making a lot more money, right? So that will happen with words, and you'll sometimes see where, take entrepreneur, right? The Bush administration began to tack entrepreneur onto workers, any worker basically who wasn't getting medical health care at his or her place of employment.
Yeah, let me stop you here, because this is a fascinating segment of the book, and I want to make sure we have plenty of time to talk
about it
after the break. Jeffrey Nunberg is my guest. He's a linguist at UC Berkeley and chairman emeritus of the usage panel for the American Heritage Dictionary. We're talking to him about his new book, The Years of Talking Dangerously. We will find out more about the new use of the word entrepreneur. And we will take your questions at 1-800-933-5372 and at think@kera.org. Back in a minute.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you to get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin this summer. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Linguist Jeffrey Nunberg is my guest. He's a commentator for Fresh Air and the New York Times. His new book is called The Years of Talking Dangerously. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. You were talking before the break, Jeff, about this term entrepreneur, which sounds like it means you're talking about someone who's really going places.
Well, when you think of an entrepreneur, well, you think of Bill Gates or Larry Ellison, somebody who's Steve Jobs, somebody who started out in a garage or carport somewhere and is now a multimillionaire, or puts new businesses together and so on. But the administration, the Bush administration, and other people began to use it a few years ago, basically to refer to anybody who was in business for him or herself. So administration would use it for instance, the guy who gets laid off from his job and starts doing dump runs in his pickup truck, or the family who take in a couple of kids doing daycare to offer daycare. They were entrepreneurs too. The implication being that they were part of the same entrepreneurial spirit that built capitalism. In fact, one reason that entrepreneur came in originally. Was as a replacement for capitalist. Capitalist got a bad name, the word, in the late 19th, early 20th century when it evoked all those top-hatted plutocrats and so on. And although capitalism was redeemed, capitalist wasn't. So you very rarely see Bill Gates referred to as a great capitalist. And the Wall Street doesn't sing the virtues of our own American capitalists. Entrepreneurs is the word that's used. In fact, entrepreneurs is used now even within corporations. They want their employees to be entrepreneurial, which means that they behave as if it were their own business. They have a sense of ownership, another word that's evoked in this context. So entrepreneurs has been shifted to this other meaning, but in the hope that it will still retain the positive value that it had when it referred to these the people who started these great businesses.
Well, and I guess it works because people would much rather consider themselves an entrepreneur than just being self-employed.
Well, for a while, anyway. I mean, the thing about these terms is that they work as euphemisms for a while, and then they acquire a new meaning. I mean, employee was from the French employé, and was a rather elegant term for a clerk.
Huh.
I'm not a clerk, I'm an employé. Well, employee now doesn't have any of that pizzazz. Being a sales associate once was going to be a step up from just being a salesperson or a salesman at outfits like Walmart. I don't know that people at Walmart still think of themselves, well, I'm an associate, I'm not just a salesperson. Ultimately, the word is colored by the things it denotes, and that's why euphemisms, you have to keep, it's like you have to keep adding new layers of paint to the floor as it yellows and put new euphemisms on things.
Yeah, it makes me think of a friend who jokes that whenever someone is laid off, they are promoted to freelance, which of course
right.
is just a joke.
Right. In fact, Jared Bernstein, who was an economist, is now Biden's chief economic advisor, coined this phrase, involuntary entrepreneur, for somebody who was kicked out of work. I make it one of the great phrases of the Bush administration.
Sometimes it seems to matter where we hear certain things. And you write about Don Imus' statements about the Rutgers women's basketball team, which we won't repeat, but I think everyone remembers, mm-hmm. decried from all corners. But you think that maybe he would have gotten away with those remarks had they been not on television, but only on his radio show. Can you talk about why?
Yeah, for some reason, we allow things on radio, and certainly in the press, but on radio that we don't allow on television. The remarks for which Rush Limbaugh was canned from his job at ESPN as a football commentator, were very mild compared to things he says routinely on his radio show, but for which no one has suggested removing him or disciplining him. And I think that has to do in part with the idea that television is just comes into our living rooms, and radio we listen in on our cars, or the television we might just hit on something flipping through the channels, and radio, you've got the presets, so you're less likely to do that. Maybe it's the idea that a radio conversation, particularly one of the conversations that goes on shows like Limbaugh's, is is a conversation among a group of insiders rather than something addressed to the public in general. One striking difference between the way you do your show, for example, and NPR does in general, and the way people like Limbaugh does, is that on NPR they address the listeners in the singular you. When you go home, you get into your car, or you get yourself. Those are all singular forms. On Limbaugh will always be saying, well, you guys out there, or when you get yourselves a new car, there's an implication not of talking to each individual listener separately, but rather to talking to a group that's assembled somewhere. And that really colors the way we hear the language of these shows.
Well, and it's also, as you started to point out earlier, people might flip on ESPN without looking for any sort of political commentary, particularly that which they would find offensive, whereas if they turn on Limbaugh, they have come to it with an expectation of what they're going to get.
Right. That's absolutely right. Mm-hmm. It's a question of kind of, but there's strange contextual. For instance, we allow now, you know, there was a time when you couldn't use four-letter words in public. Right, just ever, anywhere. Now we have these strange conditions. You can use them on pay cable. You can use them on free cable, but you got to bleep them, and you can't use them at all on broadcast.
Yeah.
You can use them in New Yorker, but not in the New York Times. So there's this very strange set of assumptions we make about when language is appropriate that would have mystified the Victorians, who just thought, this is bad language. You don't ever say this anywhere. Now we sort of agree that everybody says it, but there are certain contexts where we pretend that it's never used.
Well, it is interesting because I have heard people who will swear in conversation with their friends and colleagues who are shocked and offended when they hear it. Is that partially because we've sort of protected ourselves from hearing this on broadcast TV and radio?
I think so. And, I think there is a shock value to it. That's why it's still effective. And I wouldn't want it to become so ordinary that it lost that value. But nonetheless, everybody knows that everybody uses this language, and yet there are certain contexts in which we have to pretend we've never heard it.
Do you think that that has to do also in part with the fact that we have kind of a strange, we attach a lot of profanity to acts of sex, and therefore it has a different weight perhaps than other kinds of words?
Yeah, in modern times, this is quite recent actually. The strongest imprecation, the strongest swear words, are the ones based on sex, elimination, and the body. Generally speaking, they weren't that common in the 19th century. And when you see the show Deadwood, for example, one thing that only a linguist would be troubled by this, but nobody talked that way in Deadwood in the 1860s and 1870s. They would have used things like gall darn. And hell's a pot, you know, all of these denatured profanities that we associate with Yosemite Sam. But it was an age still in which religiously based profanity was the worst thing you could say. And the F word, while used in a literal sense to refer to sexual intercourse, wasn't used in these extended ways as a general all-purpose intensifier. Nor were most of the other expressions that you hear used on those shows. So it's quite recent. It really begins with the First World War, becomes more widely known with the Second World War, and doesn't enter the ordinary American vocabulary until the 1970s. It's a very recent phenomenon, a very interesting one for me.
Do you think that Deadwood was influenced, the writers of that were influenced by the success of The Sopranos on HBO?
Well, surely, but I think they did the right thing. You wanted to indicate that these were people who had no respect for the ordinary conventions and proprieties, and that they would say things that were shocking. That's the language that's shocking to us. If you had used the language that was actually shocking to contemporaries, it would have just sounded silly to us.
So we'd roll our eyes and think, what is this?
Right. So in the interest, you could make it more historically correct, but it would lose its dramatic force. And they were not making a history. They were making a drama.
Your chapter on the language of death is very interesting to me. For one, it's amazing how different a phrase like aid in dying sounds as compared with assisted suicide.
Right. In fact, it's striking that in polls, if you ask people whether doctors should be allowed by law to end the lives of patients suffering from incurable disease, about 75% say they should. If you change the wording of the question as permitting doctors to assist a patient in committing suicide, it goes down to only 58%, which is still a majority, but a much smaller majority. So So that's one place where the choice of words is enormously important in shaping people's attitudes.
Are you surprised at all that we still use euphemisms instead of the word died almost any time that it's possible? People would much rather say gone or passed away.
No. In the first place, it isn't as if death has gotten less scary. I mean,
yeah.
We put it off a little bit, but it's still out there, right? And it's the first thing, even before sex, that everybody's going to euphemize. That's hard to deal with, and that people find other words with it, other words for it. And if you look back, how many of the words associated with death are originally euphemistic? Execution, for example, was a euphemism. Capital punishment, certainly, also a euphemism for killing someone. Suicide itself was a 17th century word that was a euphemism for what Shakespeare called self-slaughter, self-murder. Mm. Collateral damage, a euphemism for killing civilians. So we've always euphemized these things, and there've always been dozens and dozens of words for death and dying, and it's appropriate in some way when you go to console a friend, you might want to use a word. So when your husband passed, for example, might soften the blow. And it's not, you might say, well, I'd rather use direct language and so on. But, you know, when you're talking to somebody and trying to soften the pain of loss, you use whatever language works in that context. You don't stand on your own principles. In that sense, I think it's natural that we do euphemize these things.
I was really interested in the chapter on the art of the public apology as opposed to the non-apology. Will you give us an example to kind of explain the difference?
Well, the non-apology is really a notion that begins in the 1970s. The non-apology is a way of making contrite noises without actually saying you're sorry. And so you get all these elaborate, often very clever ways of making the point. Actually, it began with Herbert Hoover was the first issuer of a non-apology, something was called a non-apology. Pope Benedict, I'm deeply sorry for the reactions in some countries to a few passages of my address which were considered offensive. So, well, I'm sorry, but, you know, it was the way they reacted, and they considered them offensive. I don't think they were offensive. So it's a way of making contrite noises without actually accepting any of the blame. When Charles Stimson, the Defense Department official, said it was shocking that American attorneys, were representing the people at Guantanamo, and suggested that their corporate clients might want to withdraw their business. He was forced to apologize. He said, "Regrettably, my comments left the impression that I questioned the integrity of those engaged in the zealous defense of the detainees." And so forth. Mel Gibson's apology for his anti-Semitic remarks. It's become an art form in America, and we parse them with great gusto. And in a funny way, that's something that we always do. It's something we learn to do as children. Your mother says, "You call that girl and say you're sorry." So you got on the phone and say, you pick up the phone, you say, "I'm sorry I called you fat," and then you hang up the phone. Now, it's clear that you're not sorry, but the lesson isn't that you should be genuinely contrite, but that there are things you shouldn't say, and that if you say them, you should be forced to apologize for them. And I think in that sense, these public apologies do their work even if the person isn't genuinely admitting responsibility, because the point is that the social pressure has forced them to go out and make at least an ostensible apology.
Well, it's interesting that they do work at all, because it seems to me that anyone other than a child sees straight through these things whenever they happen.
Well, yeah, no, we see straight, and we don't for a moment believe, for the most part, that these people actually are feeling contrite about what they said, about what they did. But the fact is that they do acknowledge that what they said is something for which they are obliged to make contrite noises.
Well, and they often seem to come with sort of a veiled insult right back to the people who took offense in the first place. "I'm sorry you were so stupid as to misinterpret
right.
what I had to say."
Anybody who was insensitive and stupid enough to think I intended anything, I'm sorry. Who was it who said, I've got it here and I'm going to vamp while I find it. My favorite non-apology was it's not coming to me.
We'll find it in a second.
Bob Packwood, Senator Bob Packwood, 1992, accused of having sexually assaulted several dozen women, replied with what has to be the most dubiously penitent apology anybody in American public life has ever uttered. I'm apologizing for the conduct that it was alleged that I did. At that point, you just about give him the prize and pack it in. That's it. But he nonetheless acknowledged that what he did, or what he was alleged to did, required that he go out and make these noises.
Well, what's really remarkable is that we are absolutely shocked on those rare occasions when a public figure does come forth and admit being sorry for something that really just happened.
Right. It's often very hard to tell. Is that just a very skillful apology? A skillful political move, or is it genuine contrition?
Yeah.
And sometimes people may feel contrition and not be able to bring themselves to apologize. So I think it's more on the order of a public ceremony and should be thought of that way. It isn't as if it makes things right. It isn't as if we really care what the person's going on in the person's heart. It isn't, after all, like the apology we expect from our spouse or our children or our parents when they do something bad. It's more just a kind of theater of contrition, which is very important, which keeps people in line. If you say this stuff, you're going to go out there and say you're sorry.
Jeffrey Nunberg is my guest. He is a linguist at UC Berkeley and chairman emeritus of the usage panel at the American Heritage Dictionary. He's also a commentator for Fresh Air and for the New York Times. We're talking about his new book, The Years of Talking Dangerously. If you would like to join the conversation, you can give us a call at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We'll be back in just a minute.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you to get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin this summer. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with linguist Jeffrey Nunberg. His new book is called The Years of Talking Dangerously. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. I want to talk, Jeff, about the essay you included called When Words Break Down. You talk about terms like looting, which didn't quite make sense in describing what was taking place after Hurricane Katrina.
Yeah, it was very interesting. The word, people just threw the word out there for anybody who was breaking into a store and taking something. And then they realized that there were these distinctions to be made, these ethical distinctions, particularly as it became clear that the whole assistance program had broken down, and that it was one thing to smash a store window and go in and take out a flat screen television, and another to break into a convenience store and take some milk and bread for your kids. And at that point, people became uncertain as to how to talk about this. Some people said, "Well, we'll use looting for this and not for the other." Other people said, "We can't make the distinction. We'll use looting for everything," which is what the Times did. And other people, other editors said, "You know, we're just not going to use that word, because we don't know why the person is taking somebody's taking a ladder from a home repair store. Maybe he's trying to get his mama off the roof." So the word was by some people abandoned. It's an example of what happens when the familiar language, moral language that we use, suddenly comes up against a realm of experience that's obviously morally much more complicated than we had assumed, and we're forced to examine the language. and in that sense examine our own attitudes too.
Well, and what's really interesting about it is that everyone seemed to understand collectively that the word looting was loaded enough that it couldn't possibly take on a more benign meaning in this circumstance.
Right, and that if you simply had a bailout on the word, and then other people said, well, but you know these people are looting, we should use looting all the way, or the sort of moral absolutist. It was one of these cases. I mean, I don't really think it matters entirely how you come down on these things. I think the important thing is that once you start throwing these words up and beginning to realize that they're breaking down, that they're not working for you, it encourages a kind of reflexiveness, a reflectiveness about language that's useful, because you no longer accept that automatic and unthinking relationship between words and things in the world.
And then there are times when words have a very subtle shift in definition, and I think you write in the book, or else something that I've read recently, about the word snarky, which means something different today than it did a couple of decades ago, at least in this country.
Right. No, snarky is a really interesting. In fact, I have a little something about it in the book, and I'm just finishing a fresh air piece on the word. It's interesting because it's always interesting when you get a new word for something that's been around for a while. It isn't as if we snarkiness is a new sensibility where people haven't been snarky going
sadly,
back to Alexander
no.
Pope. I mean, I can tell you, you know, and particularly, you know, adolescent girls it's a form that adolescent girls master when they're about 12 or 13 years old. But we've got a new word for it, for this particular variety of it. And I think that suggests that we've assigned it a new place culturally, that all of a sudden it's an acceptable sensibility or a sensibility that some people value, and in the whether it's in the blogs or the talk shows or other media like that, being snarky, being pert, in your face, however you want to describe it, edgy, has become an acceptable form of reaction.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Marie in Arlington. Hey, Marie.
Yes, I wanted to ask about a term I really despise. It's ethnic cleansing. Cleansing being a word that we normally associate with something positive. And it seems to me that the perpetrators of genocide invented this term and that the press very uncritically bought into this propaganda and started using it like crazy.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. It happened some years ago, and it clearly was a euphemism. But what's interesting about words like that, as I suggested, is that after they've been used for a while as a euphemism, they lose their euphemistic character, and they become just words for that thing. So I don't think ethnic cleansing is now a euphemism. If you say accuse somebody of ethnic cleansing, it isn't as if you're trying to let them off lightly. It's been going on for a long time. The word casualty was originally a euphemism introduced during the Crimean War for people who were killed or wounded in warfare. It was a kind of way of not talking about those who were killed or wounded. Now, casualty no longer has that feel. Casualty is just the name of that thing. And I think that's what's happening with ethnic cleansing. It happens with a lot of these words. So at least you can have the consolation of knowing that euphemisms only remain euphemisms for a while.
You also write about the fact that there are a lot of myths in existence as related to the origins of words. Can you talk about what makes them so powerful and why they can, in some cases, be sort of dangerous?
Well, there are all these myths of all sorts. We have to believe that words have these interesting stories behind them. So people say things like, well, you know, back in Elizabethan times, when it was cold in England, the cats and dogs used to hide in the thatch of the roof until there was a big rainstorm and it would wash the cats and dogs down. And that's why we say raining cats. I mean, these goofy, impossible stories. But people, and the Internet is full of stuff like that. And they're generally entertaining, except for linguists who find them maddening because it's just so wrong. But there are other stories of this type that serve another purpose and are more complicated, but equally wrong. You see that this story, for instance, that rule of thumb originated from a law variously identified as being in Massachusetts and other places that said a man could only beat his wife with a stick no thicker than his thumb. A great story, but has no beginnings in fact, no roots in fact. The story that faggot came from the medieval practice of burning homosexuals on faggots on piles of wood. Again, a great story, but actually faggot comes in the mid-19th century and is actually first used for a woman and then shifts to a man.
And the word initially it meant like a kindling, is that right?
It was kindling, and then for some reason was shifted to mean a disagreeable woman, and then after that became a name for an effeminate man through a process we're not sure. But nothing to do with medieval burning and so on. Bull Dyke is identified with Boudica, British queen from the 5th or 6th century, whenever it is. Well, no, it's first testified in the early 20th century. It has nothing to do with that. So these stories are out there. People take a kind of consolation in them. They seem to validate some idea about the group. And you can see why socially what work they do, but they're just wrong. And the Internet's full of them. The Internet may be a wonderful tool for the diffusion of information, but the misinformation is barely a step behind.
We should say that you actually, I don't want to say own up, but you write in the book that you have, in fact, contributed some information to Wikipedia.
Oh, yeah. No, I like Wikipedia. And I, under various pseudonyms, I contribute articles to things, to everything from the article on "I Fought the Law," the song, to obscure baseball players with a giant. Even every once in a while to a linguistic topic, but
so you don't limit yourself to linguistics.
No, I think the point of Wikipedia is that it's this amateur exercise, and it's on the one hand brilliant and gives you enormous amounts of useful information. On the other hand, is incredibly dangerous. What's interesting, I think, is the way in which people in general, and I think smart users of the Internet in particular, have learned when to trust it and when not to trust it.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're interested in finding out when Barry Bonds first won the National League MVP award, you go to the Wikipedia article. There's no way they could be wrong about that. There's 17,000 people contributing to that article, and every one of them considers him or herself a Barry Bonds expert, and there's no way they could get that year wrong. But in other cases, the entries are just routinely full of misinformation and mistakes. The entry on Daniel Defoe has a friend of mine went there. When he last went there, it had something like 7 errors of fact in the first paragraph, which is impressive. You have to write a fairly condensed paragraph to get that far. So, and I think that's the point, that we learn after a while when we can trust Wikipedia and when it's not going to be trustworthy.
Well, what's amazing about Wikipedia is that one of their rules is that everything on there is supposed to be able to be cited back to a published piece of journalism. And that really calls for an extraordinary faith in the power of the media to get things right in the first place.
Right. I contributed something to a piece on a fellow who's one of these a language charlatan who's out there, and he's got an article in there, and he had been interviewed by the New York Times. So they quoted the interview with him in the New York Times, and a very well-known linguist at the University of Pennsylvania, major figure in the field, had written in his blog that this was nonsense. And I cited that. I added that citation to the article, and some other contributor said, "Well, we don't self-publish stuff. Doesn't count here." So you know what the guy says to the New York Times counts, but what a major figure in the field says doesn't count. It's because they try to reduce the very complicated rules that scholars have learned over the years for when to trust and when not to trust sources to a set of rules of thumb. That all of these rather paradoxical and sometimes very silly results come out.
Let's speak next to Mike in Flower Mound. Hello, Mike.
Hi. I was listening to your article earlier, and you mentioned in support of a proposition that everyone uses profanity in private conversation. I think you said everyone does it. But there are certain situations where it's not acceptable in public, and you mentioned the television. And in truth, it's not true that everyone uses it. There's a minority that doesn't. But that language you use that to support your proposition. I think that's real common. I was just wondering what kind of minority you think, what kind of critical mass does it take to essentially, I don't,
Well, no, I think it's a very, if I may, I mean, go ahead, but I think I get what you're trying to say, and I think it's a very good point. It's very hard to know how many people use obscenity, or how many people don't use it, rather. In self-reporting surveys, the number comes in anywhere between 14% and 16%, 18% say I've never used it. In other surveys that have been done, people estimate as low as 4%. I tend to go with the lower figure just because I can see where people would tend to report that they never use it, even if they occasionally let the word slip out.
Never until you hammer your thumb or something.
I beg your pardon?
Never until you hammer your thumb and then,
right. Well, then
Katie
bar right,
the door.
For goodness sake. But it's a small proportion of people. You're, I mean, whether it's 14% or 4%, there's a minority of people, not negligible but small, who don't use the words. Although even in that case, there's virtually nobody. I mean, you know, Victorian ladies could pretend they'd never heard these words. I mean, you could actually go through your life pretending you'd never heard these words. That's not the case anymore, that you didn't know what they mean. And how many people don't speak the words but use them in their, I mean, when you're cut off by some, let me just say, jerk, on the highway going, you know, 97 miles an hour and nearly driving you off the road, the sentence that goes through your mind might very well contain a term that you wouldn't actually speak in public. So I think it's part of our inner language for evaluating people, for particularly for describing people we don't like or we think are deficient one way or another, and it's certainly part of the spoken language of, you know, ordinary American speech now. I don't believe that we should use it everywhere, or that it should be. I don't think you should be allowed to use these words on the op-ed page of the New York Times. But to pretend in some way that the words don't exist is a kind of interesting fiction, I think, at this point.
Do you think, Jeff, that we're any better or worse these days at actually communicating with one another than we have been in the past?
Gee, you know, that's so hard to measure, evaluate. Just because everybody else would say no, I would say yes, just to be contrary.
Yes to better or yes to worse?
We're better at it. Why are we better at it? Well, we do it more, and we do it over more media. People think the written language is going to hell in a handcart because they just look around them and they see all this atrocious English and misspelling and so on. But you got to think of that in another way. It's true that if you look, for instance, for IT apostrophe S or ITS, they're misused. You see them misused a lot more than you used to. But you see a lot of things misspelled, for instance, more than you used to. If you look out on the Internet, take a hard word to spell like accommodation, two C's, two M's. Only about 40% of people on the Google groups and these discussion groups get that right. It used to be that in the newspapers, you know, 99% of the time it was right because journalists knew the word and editors knew the word and they had spell checkers. Now, but the fact that the word is more commonly is seen misspelled more often doesn't necessarily mean that more people are misspelling it, just that their misspellings weren't visible before now.
Jeffrey Nunberg's new book is called The Years of Talking Dangerously. Jeff, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.